From KMXT in Kodiak, this is the Alaska Fisheries Report. I'm Maggie Wall. We're going to ease into the new year with a few good books. Two suggestions to put on your list of books to read in 2020. First up, we have the story of a Bering Sea captain. Jake Jacobson recounts tales and memories of his 5 decades fishing Alaska's dangerous and unpredictable waters. And we look at the early days of ocean exploration. Not the sailing the ocean blue kind of exploration. We're talking about the guys who went deep below the surface with all kinds of funky deep sea gear and submersibles. An interview with author and explorer Bill Streber about his book, In Oceans Deep. All that coming up on this week's edition of the Alaska Fisheries Report, right after this.
The Alaska Fisheries Report is brought to you in part by Alaska Boats and Permits, marine broker for vessels, permits, and IFQs at alaskaboat.com.
You have to be tough to survive even one season as an Alaska fisherman. Imagine 50 years of catching fish in Alaska waters. Skipper Jake Jacobson tells his story in the memoir, Chronicles of a Bering Sea Captain. Alaska Fish Radio's Lainey Welch has more.
Trying to outwit fish swiping killer whales, fights aboard 300-foot factory trawlers, falling overboard, waves in the wheelhouse. Lots of fish stories stem from a life at sea. A new book, Chronicles of a Bering Sea Captain, captures 5 decades of crabbing, trawling, and longlining in the Bering Sea. Author Jake Jacobson says the motivation came from a health scare 20 years ago at sea.
I was thinking, you know, what should I have done that I haven't done? And the thought that struck me was, I've got 6 kids. They really know very little about what I've done as far as out at sea and leave some stories for them.
Jacobson began jotting down stories in fits and starts, put it down for about a decade, and became inspired again when he came upon old notebooks and photos. He says he wrote furiously for 3 months. Chronicles was released on Amazon.com. One of his favorite stories is trying to outwit killer whales from robbing pricey fish from longline hooks.
You develop strategies and you cut your line and anchor it off and run away for a while and stop the engines, and then you come back and they leave sentries around at your strings and then they call each other.
Jacobson says in writing the book, he wanted to correct some misconceptions people might have about fishing the Bering Sea.
When I tell these stories about staying up for 3 days in a row without sleep, we're not talking about decimating the resource. We're talking about a very competitive fishery that takes a small percentage of the available biomass, and it's all controlled by the best sustainability science available.
That report was provided by Alaska Fish Radio's Lainey Welch. You can see and read portions of Chronicles of a Bering Sea Captain at beringseacaptain.com.
The Alaska Fisheries Report is brought to you in part by the Alaska Marine Safety Education Association, providing U.S. Coast Guard-accepted hands-on safety training for all of Alaska's fishermen and their families. AMSEA at amsea.org.
Support for the Alaska Fisheries Report is provided by the Stosh and Claudia Anderson Fund, supporting conservation and harvesting of Alaska's wild, sustainable fisheries.
On to the second book that you can put on your reading list for the year 2020. Scientist and world explorer Bill Streber likes to tackle big topics in his books. Streber has a gift for breaking down wonky science into compelling narratives, as he did in the book Cold and the follow-up Heat, telling the stories of the world's coldest and hottest places. He's also written about the natural history of moving air, helping readers understand why these invisible things that we can feel but not always see are so important. In his latest exploration, Strieber takes us to where he is most comfortable, the world's ocean. Strieber started commercial diving at 16. He worked underwater in a wide range of jobs. Within the pages of his book, In Oceans Deep, Strieber describes early explorations and the importance of understanding the mysteries of what's beneath the water. In this interview with Alaska Public Media's Lori Townsend, Strieber starts out with a fascinating tale of a primitive submersible that in the 1960s took explorer Don Walsh to the bottom of the deepest place in the world's oceans, Challenger Deep in the Mariana Trench.
And he did that in the submersible called the Trieste, which was, by the standards of today, an extremely primitive submersible. The flotation worked with a great big balloon full of gasoline that rode on top of the little tiny personnel capsule that carried Don Walsh and Jacques Piccard to the deepest point in the oceans.
And it had a system of magnetized steel shot. Is that correct?
That's right. So there's two issues at play with a submersible. You have to be able to sink the thing because you want to go down, but you've also got to come back up. So you have flotation on the one hand that makes you buoyant, and you've got weights or ballast on the other hand that makes you sink. And you want to be able to release that ballast at a moment's notice in case something goes wrong so that you'll float back to the surface. And in Trieste, the ballast was mostly in the form of iron shot, and that iron shot could be released by cutting the current off to an electromagnet. And then, of course, the magnetism disappears and the iron shot falls off into the ocean, and hopefully Trieste floats back to the surface with a couple of survivors on board.
And in that case, it did. These early efforts that were somewhat, as you said, primitive by today's standards for submersibles led to advancements in technology and in how people approach going to these greater depths. What would you gauge this success at as far as where we're at today with going into depth?
Well, the Trieste was a landmark expedition. So it was done at a time when it was almost just a dreamer's dream to think that you could pull this off in 1960, and they pulled it off. And Don recalls having conversations after they successfully surfaced and saying, well, it'll be a couple more years before we get to make a dive like that again. It'll take a couple more years to put everything in place and we can go back down. Well, it wasn't a couple more years. They made that dive in 1960, the next time that somebody went to the bottom of the Mariana Trench or the Challenger Deep was in 2012. And then the third time that someone went down was just this year.
Why was there such a long lag?
You know, that's a good question. I think... One thing that's happened with underwater exploration is it's always taken a backseat to space exploration. Space, and Don Walsh likes to say that, you know, the astronauts had the cool spacesuits in the great videos, and diving to the bottom of the deepest point in the ocean is all about two guys sort of hunkering together in a tiny, sweaty little sphere in the dark without much to take pictures of at all. So the romance just isn't there. And without something like NASA backing you up, undersea exploration sort of becomes an area for innovators, an area for independent workers, an area for small programs or even small projects to make inroads into our ability to reach great depths.
You train to free dive, and you're also a certified scuba diver. Tell us about what free diving is and how it differs from tank diving.
Free diving is breath hold diving. So you're taking a breath on the surface and you're going down and you're staying down until that breath runs out and you're coming back up to the surface. Free diving for me was a whole new dimension to my diving world. So I've been diving for decades, and we happened to be in a little island called Utila in Honduras. There was a free diving school there, and we went in and said, hey, we would like to try free diving. And we wound up training with these guys for altogether about 8 weeks, and went from being a sort of a typical middle-aged guy who might struggle to get down 20 or 30 feet to at one point making a dive to 132 feet on a breath of air. and to routinely diving to 60, 70, 80 feet on a breath of air.
Chapter 6 is about robotics in the ocean. Who is sending robotic explorers into the oceans and why?
So I am sending robots into the ocean to explore, but I'm a very, very, very small player, more of a hobbyist than anything else. But robots have been used since around the 1950s to explore and to work on the seabed, and it started out with a person who was actually working closely with Jacques Cousteau, went over to the U.S. Navy that was developing robots to recover test torpedoes and then later to recover all kinds of other things. Then went into the oil and gas industry, where robots were used to either help divers or, in many cases, replace divers. And I remember working in the South China Sea in the early 1980s, and a robot shows up on the vessel that I was stationed on, and we were suddenly working with this robot. So the oil field changed the underwater robotics, and of course, robots are also used by researchers all over the world. Another thing that's happened with robotics is, like almost everything that human beings get their hands on, robots are being weaponized. So you could think of some of the early sophisticated torpedoes as being a form of ROV. But today it's become even more advanced. The Russians apparently have a submersible that's capable of very high speeds, and this is an unmanned submersible, so an autonomous underwater vehicle that supposedly can travel underwater more or less undetected, very high speeds, and deliver nuclear weapons to a target. The United States is also developing a diesel-electric submarine without people, an unpersoned diesel-electric submarine that could operate at sea very quietly for a long, long period, surfacing at night to run its diesel generators and recharge its batteries, and then submerging during the day and sneaking around following commands put into its computers.
In Oceans Deep is available at booksellers. This interview with author Bill Strieber was provided by Alaska Public Media's Lori Townsend.
Support for the Alaska Fisheries Report comes from the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute, working to raise the value of our seafood harvest for the benefit of all Alaskans. On the web at alaskaseafood.org.
The Alaska Fisheries Report is brought to you in part by Alaska Sea Grant, sponsor of the Alaska Young Fishermen's Summit, a place to improve your skills and learn more about the industry, January 21st through the 23rd in Juneau. Find out more at alaskaseagrant.org.
That's it for this week's edition of the Alaska Fisheries Report. We had help from Lori Townsend with Alaska Public Media and Lainey Welch with Alaska Fish Radio. And for you fishermen, good luck in the coming year, and please put safety at the top of your New Year's resolutions. For KMXT in Kodiak, I'm Maggie Wong.